From Virginia to Nebraska, Missouri to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Trump's Remain in Mexico policy has slowed the flow of illegal immigration, but that policy is being challenged in the courts. Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation is here with details. Super Tuesday was super for Joe Biden and narrowed the Democratic primary field to two. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on what happens next. Want to give weight loss advice? Don't do it in Mississippi without a license. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Aaron Rice of the Mississippi Justice Institute about one man who was threatened with jail time. And the stock markets had wild up and down swings this past week, reacting to the coronavirus epidemic and the presidential campaign. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Trump administration has been working to curb the flow of illegal immigrants into the United States and has adopted a policy of sending asylum seekers back to Mexico while their claims are being processed. But that policy is under attack in the courts. Here with details is Hans von Spakovsky. Hans is senior legal counsel at the Heritage Foundation. Hans, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Hans, it is officially known as the Migrant Protection Protocols. Now, probably very few people in America know what that means. So tell us what it is in layman's terms and what the policy is all about.
Sure. Well, informally, it's being called the Remain in Mexico policy. And in essence, what the Trump administration did more than a year ago is they took advantage of a federal immigration statute that specifically gives them the authority to do this, but it had not been taken advantage of by prior administrations. And basically what the statute said and what the Trump administration did is this. They said, if you come across the Mexican border as an alien and you claim asylum, you will have to remain in Mexico while we determine the validity of your claim. And second, we will not consider as credible an asylum claim if you were caught sneaking across the border instead of coming through one of our official ports of entry. All of which makes perfect common sense because obviously, look, if you have a legitimate asylum claim, why would you sneak across the border? Why wouldn't you come in through a port of entry? And look, the reason for this was to end the catch and release policy because what aliens were doing was claiming asylum because they knew then what would happen is they'd be processed by the Border Patrol. They'd be given a date for when to appear before an immigration judge, and then they're released. And, of course, what do? They disappear into the vast interior of the United States, and the vast majority of them do not show up for their immigration hearing. Why would they? They don't have a legitimate claim.
Those who are promoting the idea of open borders, Hans, will obviously have been fighting this. They look to the federal courts, and it's not been overly difficult to find sympathetic judges to hear this. So this Remain in Mexico policy, as it's better known, has been appealed into the court system. Tell us what that record has been and where it stands.
This policy was extremely effective. Last year, when it was in force, they returned over 60,000 illegal aliens to Mexico. But unfortunately, you know, a whole group of open borders advocates sued. And just a week or so ago, a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, which of course covers California and is the most liberal appeals court in the country, issued an injunction saying, oh, the Trump administration doesn't have the authority to do that. The weird thing is they issued this order on a Friday, and then just a little while later, they suspended their order saying the Trump administration couldn't do that and asked the government and asked basically both sides to file some further briefs with them on the issue because the Justice Department is saying this is a national security problem. If you don't let us do this, it will interfere not only with our control of the border. But, for example, it'll make it hard to prevent people with the coronavirus from coming in. So at the moment, this really, can I say, unwise order is in suspension, but the court may put it back in place, in which case this is going to go to the Supreme Court.
Isn't it rather unusual for the court to issue an order and then stay its own order?
Yes, it is. I don't remember this happening like this before. It's been a bit confusing, but that's what happened. Look, I was unfortunately forced to read through the entire order and look at the tortured reasoning the court used. And, I mean, the court was just so wrong. It basically ignored the plain language of the federal statute, which is very clear. It's not one of those federal laws that's, you know, somehow confusing and, you know, you're not going to understand exactly what it means. It is absolutely clear and says that the administration can require any alien that comes across our land borders to remain in that other country while they're evaluating their asylum claim. It's very clear.
Now, this leaves things obviously in a state of confusion. So at the moment, the order is stayed, which means, as I would see it, the remain in Mexico policy is still in force. So the Trump administration is conducting business as it had been.
Yes, it is for the moment. We, at some point very soon, we'll hopefully find out what the court is actually going to do. And if the court basically goes back to its original order and says, Trump administration, you can't do it, what you should expect to see is an emergency appeal filed by the Justice Department with the U.S. Supreme Court.
And the expectation would be that the U.S. Supreme Court would stay the whole process until they had a chance to decide whether or not to hear the case?
Yeah, I think what they would do is say, we're not going to allow this injunction to stay in place. I think they're going to say the administration can enforce this remain in Mexico policy until we've made a final determination.
So if the injunction were to remain in effect, that means we go back to catch and release?
Absolutely, because the whole problem is, the reason we have a catch and release policy is because the Border Patrol only has a limited number of detention facilities. And those detention facilities are full up. There's only a limited number of beds in which they can house illegal aliens. And so once you get over that amount, then there's not much you can do other than give the alien a court date to appear and release them.
Okay, so that's where we are with this process. And as you mentioned, the policy, the Remain in Mexico policy, has been highly effective. Any numbers, yep, Hans, as to how many individuals have actually been returned to Mexico and are awaiting asylum?
There's over 60,000 that have been returned to Mexico. And the latest number I saw from the Department of Homeland Security is that it turns out 9 out of every 10 asylum claims turns out to be fraudulent.
You mentioned briefly the coronavirus issue, and the Trump administration's put travel bans on a number of countries. Does the fact that this coronavirus issue has arisen in such a big way, will that at all enter into the court's decision-making process, or is that just something they're totally not going to consider?
Oh, no, it should. And in fact, I believe the Justice Department has added that to the arguments it was making to the courts about the authority of the president to do this under the federal immigration statute. So it's very clear Congress gave the president the ability to do this. But in trying to give the court even more reasons to uphold what the president's doing, they definitely have used that argument.
We have been talking with Hans von Spakovsky, who is senior legal counsel at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. And Hans, tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation, also your website.
Sure. The Heritage Foundation is the largest conservative think tank in the world, actually, certainly in the United States. And folks can check that out at heritage.org, heritage.org.
Hans von Spakovsky, senior legal counsel at the Heritage Foundation. Hans, thank you for being here.
Loman, thanks for having me.
It has been a very, very busy week, both under the dome in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol, and also, of course, politically in the aftermath of Super Tuesday. We're going to work our way through all of that with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Let's pick up where we left off last week, Scott. We talked extensively about coronavirus and congressional emergency funding in order to fight the spread of this disease. Has there been any movement?
Yeah, so as you recall, last week there was $2.5 billion emergency supplemental request from the president. And this week what happened was there was a lot of political posturing. Were they going to add the reauthorization of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Authorization? Were they going to add provision related to surprise billing and price fixing and health insurance? What were they going to add to this must-pass legislation? And in the end, they kept those anomalies out of the package, but they tripled the size of the request and passed a roughly $8 billion bipartisan emergency funding deal. So the bill provides for funds to address the virus at home and abroad, including expediting vaccine development, purchasing essential equipment and supplies, and assisting state and local health departments. This is a gigantic amount of money. Sometimes Congress comes in and says, how much money can we throw at a problem and try to find a solution? And I think with the coronavirus, we're certainly learning that the markets are spooked and the American people are concerned, as we've seen already 129 cases in the United States, including cases in New York and California. And obviously the first deaths happened last week. So the coronavirus is something we're continuing to pay attention to. And obviously the biggest concern is that this becomes widespread to a point where we enter into a recession headed into October.
The other big issue on Capitol Hill this week is Chuck Schumer, the U.S. Senate minority leader, made some threats, actually, against a couple of sitting justices of the Supreme Court. This created quite an uproar. What's happening in response to Chuck Schumer's comments?
Yeah, Chuck Schumer this week was outside of the Supreme Court, and the justices were considering a case about limiting abortion in Louisiana. And what Chuck Schumer said was, he said, quote, I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you have released the whirlwind and you will pay the price. You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions, end quote. And so obviously there's been a lot of uproar with that kind of rhetoric following the shootings involving public officials like Gabby Giffords and the Republican softball team with Steve Scalise getting shot by a crazed Bernie supporter. You know, I think a lot of folks are pretty uncomfortable with Chuck Schumer doing that on both sides of the aisle. And so what we've seen now is a call for Chuck Schumer to be censured by Republican Senator from Missouri, Josh Hawley. Leader McConnell came to the floor this week and admonished Chuck Schumer for his remarks. So how that all shakes out and what it means for Chuck Schumer's leadership in the Senate remains to be seen.
Let's talk now politics. Of course, Super Tuesday this past week, and we all expected that this race for the Democratic presidential nomination, Scott, was going to be long fought, perhaps even a brokered convention. It was an amazing day for Joe Biden. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it was a big, big day for Joe Biden, and it was also a pretty big day for Bernie Sanders. Leading up to Super Tuesday, I think the writing was on the wall for some of these very ambitious younger Democrats that they weren't going to be winning states on Super Tuesday, so it was time to drop out and get behind somebody that they were willing to throw their support and their supporters behind. And so you saw Mayor Pete Buttigieg go ahead and drop out and endorse Joe Biden. You saw Amy Klobuchar drop out and endorse Joe Biden. And at the same time, Bernie Sanders, who had been pretty much coming off of strong performances in Iowa and New Hampshire, he got his butt kicked in South Carolina last weekend. So really, Joe had all this momentum heading into Super Tuesday, and despite his gaffes and his sometimes incoherent remarks that he makes, Joe Biden performed really strongly throughout the Super Tuesday states, winning Texas and also a number of other states where there were large numbers of delegates at stake. Bernie Sanders did win California, but what we're headed toward right now is a potential brokered convention. I think that Bernie is in it to win it, and so is Joe Biden. I don't think either one is willing to relent and throw their base of support behind the other. So this is one that's going to go on for a little bit longer. We know that the next wave of
presidential primary elections are on March 10th, and on March 10th we'll be dealing with primaries in Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, and Washington State, as well as one Democratic caucus in North Dakota.
Looking at this, of course, this is almost a mini Super Tuesday coming up. Some of those states, Michigan is the big delegate hall, so I guess that'll be the main battleground. Joe Biden, don't you think, somewhat has the upper hand there with all the labor union membership that you have in Michigan? And, of course, Bernie out in Washington State on the left coast. So, yes, it looks like this could go on a bit longer. And as it does proceed here, Scott, what happens with these Bernie Sanders supporters if if Joe Biden ends up being the nominee? They got shafted 4 years ago with an unlevel playing field for Hillary Clinton. Are the Bernie Sanders supporters going to be disaffected, and are they going to be able to be brought into the fold for the general election?
I think that remains to be seen. Last time, there were a lot of Bernie supporters that thought that Hillary stole the election along with the DNC from him. You need 1,991 delegates to win the Democratic nomination. Right now, Joe Biden is at 595, Bernie Sanders is at 528, and Liz Warren is all the way down at 65. So there's clearly two candidates that can take this thing a little bit farther. And as we look at sort of the big rewards of states like Michigan, when it comes to November, if the Democrats are competitive in those states and they're able to unify their base and to bring support from their opponents into line against President Trump, it's going to be another really, really close election in November, regardless of whether Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders is the Democratic nominee.
Well, we still have a number of very large states to be heard from: Illinois, Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio. So we will see where all of this goes, and we will track it each week with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. We have over 350,000 members from all 50 states in the country, and our group is united in economic freedom and liberty. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter is at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Giving weight loss advice without a license has one Mississippi woman facing jail time. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Aaron Rice of the Mississippi Justice Institute.
Imagine getting told that simply giving someone advice about what they should buy or eat was illegal. And not only was it illegal, but it could end up sending you to jail. Well, you don't have to imagine it. It actually happened to Donna Harris. She's a woman in Mississippi who has been threatened with fines and jail time for giving diet advice, getting paid to give diet advice, because it violates the state's dietitian licensing laws. And that is the case that we are going to take a look at today, folks. You are listening to American Radio Journal. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine, and my guest today is Aaron Rice. He is the director of the Mississippi Justice Institute. It's a nonprofit legal center that is representing Donna Harris. That's the woman who was, yes, threatened with jail time for giving diet advice. Crazy, crazy stuff happening down there in Mississippi. Aaron, thanks for taking some time to join us and talk about it.
Yeah, Eric, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you. Glad to have you. I wish we were talking about something that was just a little bit less nuts. Tell us about your client first, Donna Harris, and how did all of this start?
Yeah. Well, Donna is a busy working mom here in Mississippi. She's got a bachelor's degree in nutrition. She's got a master's degree in occupational therapy, and she's a certified personal trainer. And so she was looking for a way to provide more income to her family and do something she's passionate about. The members of her gym kept asking her to provide some kind of weight loss class because they know about her background in nutrition and how knowledgeable she is about it. She started doing that online for free about a year ago. She started a private Facebook group and has been sharing weight loss tips online. People love it. She developed a huge, very loyal and large following online. And her online followers were also asking her to start some kind of real program that they could have more detailed discussions and she could provide them with motivation, encouragement, and accountability. So she finally took that plunge and decided to start offering weight loss tips to paying customers who were begging her to provide that information, and they wanted to pay her for it. And as soon as she rolled that out and started signing people up, she got a cease and desist order from the Mississippi State Department of Health that threatened to throw her in jail for 6 months, fine her $1,000, and sue her in civil court.
Yeah, a bit of an overreaction by the state government, if you ask me, and certainly a bit of a over-criminalization issue here. But okay, let's acknowledge that there are maybe some circumstances in which licensing is necessary, and there are certainly some professions where public health and safety could be endangered if you have people doing certain jobs and they're not regulated by the state. I'm willing to concede that there are jobs like that. But we see this time and time again where it looks like states have just really over-licensed professions and jobs where there's no need for that sort of thing. And you end up with this situation where the people who have licenses can oftentimes keep other people out of those jobs. It just becomes sort of a protectionist racket. Is that what happened here?
We believe that a licensed dietitian reported her to the Mississippi State Board of Health. Of course, we'll find that out in this litigation and this constitutional challenge. To be clear, of course, we, like a lot of states in Mississippi, have a problem with over-licensing, not letting people work and earn an honest living. And so this is indicative of that. This is taking this situation too far where licensed dietitians, you have to be one just to provide information that is widely available online, in books, in magazines. People have been talking about the best ways to obtain a healthy weight and maintain a healthy weight since the beginning of modern civilization. So this is general information that's widely available. Of course, in this lawsuit, we are not trying to get rid of licensure completely for dietitians. There are roles for licensed dietitians providing medical diets to medical patients to treat medical conditions. But what we are claiming is that telling healthy adults what they should buy at the grocery store is a freedom that we all have as Americans, whether we're paid for that speech or not.
We are talking with Aaron Rice. He is the director of the Mississippi Justice Institute. Aaron, this is also a First Amendment issue, or at least that's how you guys are framing this legally as it moves into the courtroom. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, we brought claims under the First Amendment and additionally some other claims to say that the board is actually overstepping its bounds here because our statute, we believe, actually allows Donna to do what she's doing. Interestingly, the First Amendment claims, the Mississippi State Department of Health told Donna that she could provide this information if she only followed government-approved guidelines like the food pyramid and MyPlate.gov, which we think is very problematic to say you can do government-approved speech, but you can't engage in non-government-approved speech. There's been generals in the Army have been sounding the alarm that we have a national security crisis because they can't get enough healthy, non-obese recruits into the Army. The government has been talking about this problem for a long time. Mississippi is the most obese state in the nation, and she is simply trying to help with that problem and teach people how to eat healthy, and our government is stopping her from doing it. Another interesting thing here is that we have a crisis in our prison system in Mississippi, and we're literally having riots and people escaping right now because they're so overcrowded, and our lawmakers are trying to find ways to reduce the prison population, and yet our Mississippi State Department of Health is threatening to send sweet little Donna to prison for teaching people how to lose weight.
Yeah, Donna is really just providing a public service. I think that's a great point. She's providing a public service if only the government would let her do it and do it without just reciting government talking points. It's obvious to me, at least, that this is a free speech issue on top of being a licensing issue. And really, Aaron, you guys are really offering a public service here, too, by standing up for Donna's rights and really the rights of all Americans to talk about diet advice and talk about what you should and shouldn't eat. Though we are unfortunately out of time for today, but Aaron, thank you so much for joining us.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And again, that is Aaron Rice. He is the director of the Mississippi Justice Institute. You can read more about Donna Harris's situation, read more about this case, find links to all the legal documents in our coverage of it at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
There has been extraordinary volatility in the equity markets the past 2 weeks. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains why this is markets working as they should.
The last week of February 2020 was a wild week in the world equity markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped over 3,500 points, and the S&P index dropped over 11%. The markets were jolted by fears of a coronavirus outbreak and reacted accordingly. But wait, I've always been taught that markets were efficient. Markets are supposed to be rational, or so I thought. The reality is that the markets were being efficient with the reaction to the coronavirus. The markets were free to react as the buyer and sellers wished, based on what they perceived to be the risks to the economy. The theory never mentions that buyers and sellers will act rationally, but only that they will act. It's called the efficient market hypothesis. And the efficient market hypothesis does not require, and I quote, that investors be rational. It says that individual investors will act randomly, but as a whole, the market is always right. In simple terms, efficient means normal. For example, an unusual reaction to unusual information is normal. If the crowd starts suddenly running in one direction, it's normal for you to run in that direction as well, even if there isn't a rational reason for doing so, unquote. The significance of understanding the emotions and emotional responses behind buying and selling decisions in world markets is to help us put in perspective that market prices and stock markets are not always rational indicators of economic performance. Understanding free markets helps us navigate the newly restored liberties to our economy since President Trump was elected. With the coronavirus outbreak, world markets are reacting to what may happen and not what did happen. We have had these types of events before, and it's important that we lead the event rather than the event leading us into a recession. There are certain rules of law that fall within the purview of man, and there are significantly more important truisms of markets that defy the laws of man. Whenever man attempts to interfere with these truisms, chaos ensues. During the presidency of Barack Obama, he managed to violate many free market principles which had previously guided our economy. The Trump presidency has reversed many of his predecessor's policies, leading to significant economic expansion. This phenomenal economic expansion is due to adhering to certain truisms affecting all markets. These principles are based upon economic self-interest, which influence the performance of free markets. President Trump is attempting to reassert the economic principles behind these truisms. The first principle is governments can never react as quickly as free markets. Despite efforts by government to react, the reactions are just what the name implies, a reaction. Free markets, however, can be proactive. Governments solve yesterday's problems with yesterday's solutions, thereby setting the stage for tomorrow's crisis. Government provides the framework for the economy but cannot control it. President Trump understands that and is asking for calm for market participants and not more government intervention. The second truism is that free markets will always win. The concept of a black market is deliberately designed to circumvent the rules that governments put into place to begin with. Government's attempt at prohibition is perhaps another example of this second truism. After much fanfare, all prohibition managed to do was organize crime in this country. The real issue, alcoholism, was barely impacted at all. The third rule of free markets is you cannot tax your way to prosperity. Taxes are an expense to individuals, corporations, and the public. If taxes are too high, capital will flee your markets, investment will slow, and economic problems will follow. A fourth principle is governments always overreact and underperform. President Trump is asking us to remain calm because we hold the key to how this coronavirus crisis affects us. Government can facilitate remedies, but free markets will always win. Finally, the last principle is one that I hope all will consider very carefully. That principle is that nations can fail. Governments should provide the framework for how we live, not interfere in our economic lives by attempting to control the economy. With the principles that I have observed, it is obvious to me why our founding fathers wrote the Constitution the way they did. I would encourage all citizens to read our Constitution very carefully. Our founding fathers understood the role of government. Government should provide the calm and defense, the framework for commerce, and provide for the rule of law. Nothing more and nothing less. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WARF-AM and WHLO-AM in North Canton, Ohio, along with WKBN-AM in Youngstown, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.